You have to hand it to Nathan Englander. In his most recent collection of short stories, he goes where most other writers would be afraid to go by evoking the ghosts of two major 20th century literary and cultural icons. And that's just with his title, what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank. He was on our show back in March to discuss that collection of eight stories, which are filled with characters who wrestle with their sense of identity and in doing so seek out and run from the past. Listeners told us they enjoyed our conversation, and we are airing it for you again today. I began by congratulating Nathan on the review on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, which was a rave.
It did not pass me by. I was very excited about that.
Raymond Carver and Anne Frank in one sentence. What do you hope to evoke by putting her name and reference to him in a title?
Yeah, I was going to say Anne Frank's in the title, but she's not in the book. I think that's representative to me of the whole, it's sort of more exploring ideas of how we remember the Holocaust and all that, but I better jump on the Carver thing first. I guess the title story, which is about two couples who play what I call the Anne Frank game or the Who Will Hide Me game or the Righteous Gentile game, which is really this idea as a Jewish kid in Long Island. I thought a game until the book was out in the world. I thought it was a game my sister invented that was only played in our house, but it was who would hide us in the event of a second Holocaust.
Now, why was the Holocaust that important in the imaginations of two kids who grew up in a family that was fourth or fifth generation American?
Yeah, this gets back to, you know, I know what the Holocaust is in history. I know what the historical event was, and I know what the genocide was, and I try and understand many of the, you know, fingers of history that move out from it. But then there's this idea of Holocaust education, and we were raised Orthodox out in suburbia, and that was just, you know, it was just central to, it was a defining characteristic of how we were raised and part of our education. So it became part of us.
Well, Anne Frank has played a role in the consciousness of or imaginations of Jewish writers. Philip Roth brought it back to life in The Ghostwriter, and Shalom Auslander in Hope, a Tragedy. You haven't brought her back to life here, but it goes beyond Jewish writers. If you go to Amsterdam, people line up to see the Anne Frank House, and not all of them are Jewish. So she plays some kind of very powerful role in many people's imaginations.
Well, which is the idea. There's the person, again, I've been to the house in Amsterdam, and it's very moving to see. And again, do not forget Anne Frank, that's the idea. But even the tree out the window has its own life and now, you know, and now death. But the very idea of the tree has become a central totem.
Because the tree
history.
Is dying.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
People are concerned because she wrote so movingly
About that tree. But yeah, I think it was out in San Francisco, but someone told me about teaching it to students. And that's what I worry about is how memory and history and education work, saying students thinking of Anne Frank as a character, almost, you know, like something out of Huck Finn or something, the idea where the historical person becomes character.
Well, one of the characters in that story calls his wife's preoccupation with the Holocaust an act of pathology.
I think that's where in my other books, you know, it's ideas of intimacy. I usually feel safe if I want to explore themes from my own life or my own emotion. I'll set it in Argentina or under Stalin, that kind of distance. But this book, I really a lot more often took a half step back and thinking about our obsession with Holocaust. I mean, it's just there is the memory and respect for the memory, but this idea of how it gets used or how it's assimilated or all that, there is a pathological element. Again, to games like that, I know kids who, you know, little kids all over who, you know, adults now, but who had nightmares of Nazis coming, you know, would pack a bag if they're going to be kidnapped by Nazis. You know, this idea of that living fear is really interesting to me.
Did that story begin with the Raymond Carver story? Or
no,
did you just like his title?
I was going to say there was this game and the way stories sit, I carried it in my head for 20 years, this idea, this moment of my sister saying about a couple, he would hide us and she would turn us in. That really, as looking into someone's soul that way, that kind of private take stayed with me. But when the story started to form, once I was writing it, I had one couple, I had another couple. Once it started to take shape and I had two couples in a room, I thought of a very legendary story to me. I thought of the Carver story, and I thought of the Way story, not the story itself, not the written story, but the Carver story had turned to dust the way a story should and had become memory. And in my memory, I had these two couples at a table and that bottle of gin, and that's when I saw the link.
They hadn't seen each other for 20 or so years, and they meet again, and things have changed. Early in the story, a wife gently lays her hand on her husband in a kind of classic marital signal, to back off, but that gesture isn't available to the other couple.
Yes, they're Hasidic, and that's the idea. You know, it's we weren't Hasidic growing up. We were Orthodox, but to me, still, the whole world looks naughty to me, but we weren't in school. We weren't allowed to touch at all. There was no kind of contact between boys and girls. So, you know, this idea, adults, I just didn't see much of that in a day-to-day, and Hasidim for sure. So, yes, I thought about this. I mean, it's part of my own relationship as you know, here we are in New York. I'm so happy to see you again. But fast-talking New Yorkers, when I'm with my sort of girlfriend's friends from other places, I sometimes get the hand, you know. My feeling is if you can't take over the conversation, you shouldn't be talking. New York rules. So the point is, I get the hand when it's time to let somebody else maybe speak.
But when those rules are imposed because of religious restrictions, it changes the relationship of the marriage, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think this is that idea. I mean, this is, I think, a battle that's sort of raging in America today, which is why, you know, fiction works. I might be writing about Hasidim who live in Israel, but to me, where do these ideas come from? Where I look at how America is split now and it gets wider and, wider, the gap and the pressures, whether it's, you know, birth control or Rush Limbaugh going crazy on his own show, which seems to be a daily occurrence. But the point is, you know, it's that idea that everyone thinks their way of life is the only way of life. It's this, you know, way we, again, I think to not have chaos or to not panic, but to think this is the only way to be. And I just like to put two versions of this is the only way to be together. That makes story for me.
But isn't this also two versions of who you are, having grown up with one set of rules and then rejecting them and adopting, I won't say another set of rules, but a different way of seeing the world?
No, I think actually another set of rules is good. It might be less shapeless. It might be, you know, have less form in a sense, or, you know, be less didactically shaped than the previous set of rules. But yeah, I'm a big defender of the fact that just because your morality is not a wholly religious morality, that it's any less moral. I think that's often an argument of the deeply religious, that without religion, your morality, you can just choose to be like, I'm going to go eat a baby for lunch. You know, like that's not going to form. But
the big argument in the Brothers Karamazov, whether without God we are free to commit any crime.
Any crime, exactly that. And I was going to say, plenty of crimes are committed with, you know, the point is humans are humans. And I think that's the idea. They are fallible and they do horrible things and lovely things. But I was going to say, you and I have been having this, we've been talking for a long time, but that is right to the heart of it. I think this, exactly, I have lived both sides of that life. And I think that's what interests me. I have to have, you know, I sit there all day writing these stories. For me, it's about being able to inhabit both these worlds that I think is what interests me in my brain.
Do you ever think about what your life might have been like if you hadn't decided to reject the orthodoxy? Because there are plenty of people who will judge you harshly as a result.
Sure, yeah, I think I can picture that life pretty well. I mean, I was going to say part of the writing life, whenever I'm asked, can you picture? I say, I can picture that exactly. That's what I do.
That's what you do. You're a writer.
But you know what? I know a million people have stayed in that life. I can picture myself in any one of those communities. And, you know, I'd have about a 35-year-old son at this point. But, I can see that life very clearly. But the one part I also see of it is, for me, is I wouldn't have been very happy.
Mm-hmm. Whereas other people are very happy within that life.
My sister is true. We don't know evil eye, but yes, she is deeply joyous in that world.
My guest is Nathan Englander. His latest collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, published by Knopp. You've mostly written short stories.
I was going to say, I'm just happy to, as I said, where I always say I write book now. I can't believe I'm back with a third book. But yes, now that we have two collections and one novel, that gives me a mostly on the story side.
But that would suggest that you either write mostly stories and once in a while a novel emerges, or you're working on a novel and short stories just keep on popping into your head.
I think it was the last couple of years I've been working, you know, I think it actually was pub date was yesterday, but I did a translation of the Haggadah that Jonathan Safran Foer edited. I'd been working as a translator the last couple of years, and I'd been writing a play that's opening at the Public in the fall. Suddenly, I was doing these things by which I did not define myself, and it actually drove me back to the story in a beautiful way. I started thinking of how we define ourselves, how I'd started calling myself a writer, what that even means, and it reminded me of my deep love. You know, it just all the stories came rushing back, or new stories came rushing back is the point, rushing in.
Now, is there a need for a new translation of the Passover Haggadah? Didn't the Maxwell House version suffice?
That is a great version. I said even Amazon cannot beat a price of free. There's something, I don't even know what it is, if there's 50 million
copies. I love the hills skippeth like rams.
Exactly. That is a beautiful line. Yeah, you know what? That is a beautiful liturgy, and that's the one I grew up on. That is, you know, it's really, the Hebrew is wonderful, and the liturgy is wonderful. Yeah, I think it's just a very living document. The Haggadah is the point.
For a while after that one, I started seeing Haggadahs that sort of suggested that the Haggadah was a way of promoting the American way.
And oh, God. Well, this is why you know, Jonathan went with the idea of New American Haggadah as a title. But yes, you know what? They've promoted many ways. It's always of a place, the Sarajevo Haggadah, or there's, you know, cities always claim them. People always claim them. And I had no idea until I got involved with this project. So many people make their own every year, just full of current events and things torn from the news.
There's a wonderful story, a very funny one, about a man in your book who's married a Gentile, modified his name, and pretty much left his Orthodox Jewishness behind. His name is Alan Fine, and he goes into a peep show in Times Square, and his first token, as expected, gives him access to women in various states of undress. But then when he puts more tokens in, the curtain raises, and they reveal his former rabbis who harangue him about his profane ways. It's incredibly fun to read. Was it fun to write?
Oh, thank you. That, you know, I was going to say, as a book takes form, I'm a deep believer that, you know, reading a collection of stories, you should have the same feeling as when you finish a novel. Every story better need to be in there, and there better be an arc to that book. But that's the most of the stories I wrote last year, but that's one that I pulled from 12 years ago that really felt with this book. Fit inside this book. And it was, again, I feel like when that story was in the New Yorker 12 years ago, it was really shocking. And our world has changed so deeply. It's become sort of a fun story. Thanks for saying it that way. But I was thinking, it was then watching Times Square change. If you put a token in anything in Times Square, you know, Eminem's going to come out or Mickey Mouse. It's become totally Disneyfied. And I thought about the way people change. Basically, Alan Fine is, to me, he is Times Square. I thought about the way you can change the face of something, and if that changes its heart. Like, as much as they clean up Times Square, I feel like it's a certain place to me. But yes, that was a naughty and fun story to write, absolutely.
But at one point, Alan Fine complains that the rabbis are, in fact, committing a halachic crime.
Yes.
How are they doing that?
Well, there's all ideas that we grew up with, Gezel Dat, Gezel Zman. I still, you know, theft of knowledge, theft of time. There's all these ideas of theft. I still can't tell a joke. I might ruin a joke by telling the chain of the 10 people who told it to me. I have a real rabbinic head where I have to say, well, Leonard Lope told me that joke, and he heard it from his brother, who heard it from his uncle. But the point is, you know, I feel like that's what happens often with organized religion, is there's a pick and choose of the law so that people say, oh, we have to do this, but then ignore that element of the Bible. And I think he is in the peep show, and whether he belongs there or not, the rabbis, he has paid for his time with the ladies, and by rabbis appearing, they are in fact stealing from him.
Well, does that story illustrate that someone may leave the community he's been raised in, but will always be pleading his case in its courtroom?
Yeah, and I think so. And, back to you talking about my childhood or bringing that up, I think it's, in a sense, the way my head works, you know, this idea where I don't know when I dig into, you know, a pork chop and don't think pork chop. You know, sometimes you forget these ideas. I guess that goes back to the, you know, Anne Frank in the title, is as much as I forget things or change things or believe differently, my synapses fire in a certain way. And I'm so interested it's a question, what is yourself? If I say this is me now, or this is who I deeply am, what are all these other things that are flashing through my brain at any given time?
I remember somebody told me that it occurred to him that if you took a Catholic atheist, a Jewish atheist, a Baptist atheist, a Buddhist atheist, a Taoist atheist, it doesn't matter, all your Reuben atheists, and put them all in a room, the only thing they'd have in common is that they don't believe in God, because they grew up in such different cultures. The cultures, to a large degree, define them. I'm talking about the religious cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like – and that's where I feel like stuff like that, we say, you know, what is it to – I just had a flash of our Mr. Silberman's talk, but that's a whole separate matter. Back to cultural things from children. But I just think that there's a crossover of culture and then space also, because I feel like when I was living in Iowa for grad school, where I started to meet people who were, you know, the Jews of Iowa, and sometimes I'd think, oh, my friend who is, you know, Korean in New York is so, you know, I started to think, what does it mean to be Jewish? Because I feel like, in a sense, so much of that stuff, of cultural stuff, crosses over, where I feel like half the stuff I consider to be Jewish, you know, knowing who makes the best bagel or whatever, might even be being a New Yorker. So I do think all that stuff feeds in, but I feel like place, you know, the things we put on religion might also be very much tied to place.
But Fine's psychiatrist also joins the rabbis inside the window. What's his place there?
Well, I also think of what, you know, back to identity and Jewishness, and when you listed all those people, and it made me think that New York plays into Jewishness, my idea of Jewish life, as much as the Judaism part. But I think talk therapy is surely the modern religion for the, you know, the standard. I used to live on the Upper West Side forever. I think I'd see people didn't even know what to say to me. Friends from all over the city, I'd see them getting out of the subway and they didn't know what else to say except therapy. I'd be like, why else are you 100 blocks for work or 100 blocks from home? But as someone without a day job, I would just see literally everyone I know in the city just coming out of 96th Street on their way to get their 50-minute hour.
Fine accuses the rabbis of talking in an affectedly Jewish way. Weren't you accused by one of your professors of writing your sentences in transliterated Yiddish?
The beloved Marilyn Robinson. I was going to say people that...
I can't believe it's Marilyn Robinson, because later we're going to talk about Marilyn Robinson on the show.
Oh, the best person to talk about. But you think, you know, people say, can you teach writing? You know, no one knows anything in the... like. Voice is voice, and I think in one sense you need to be born with voice, but the other, how are you supposed to know if that voice is in there till you've written yourself blind? And I think that idea of the amount that I learned being around these, again, that time there was really life-changing for me, but Marilyn, again, has such a truly golden ear, and she's the one who taught me that I had these rhythms that were again, just flipped. I had a flip New York Yiddish. The rhythm of my rabbis was so beat into my head, it was coming out of my sentences. And I literally still, till today, when I write a sentence, I call it, I translate it to English from English.
But Salman Rushdie has argued that all the people who come to English as another language, whether they're from India or from Africa or whatever, have enriched the English language because they have brought that other sensibility, that other language sensibility with them.
Yeah, I was going to say in that part, I mean, that's a beautiful point. But if you, I was just thinking about his books on the cab over, in fact. But if you think of, I don't know what, Midnight's Trilogy, like it's not just even language or rhythm, but it's, again, people's, you know, because to me it's English to English. But it's, I think it's as much as how other culture enriches language, it's other forms of storytelling. Because I'm, you know, I have endless holes. It's unbelievable. You know, I still haven't read The Diary of Anne Frank, as many interviews as I do talking about her, but that's not, wasn't part of, you know, there's millions of holes.
You've never read the book.
I have never read the book. But you know, it's that idea that was not part of, we didn't have the traditional Catcher in the Rye education. And for some reason, it's so loaded, I don't ever pick it up. But I think I will now that I'm living with this one. But I think it's as much the style of storytelling, where maybe I wasn't reading the standard books, but I was just hearing the Bible as a living thing, I think, just put story in my head in a different way.
This story you mentioned is rather old. It was supposed to be in your first collection. Have you rewritten it? Do you, when you look at old works, do you think, oh, gee, I should use this word rather than
you know
one?
What? As a hopeless neurotic, which I am, there's just certain things that have to be clear in life. And I, you know, it's funny when I teach at Hunter College's MFA in the spring, and I teach for NYU in the summer. The point is, when students want to race out a book or something, it's this idea. I honestly just deeply believe there is no rush. You want work, you better be happy with it and want your name on it till you're dead, because it better be part of you forever. And the one thing I let go of, if I finish something, my process is intense and long. When it's done for me, I stand by it.
When you're reading it in public, I know a lot of writers suddenly cross out words, put other words in.
There's a separate choices for reading, but I was going to say you better decide. I often read stuff out loud because a comma will really cut you in the heart if it's out of place in a finished work. So, I try to avoid that.
You mentioned that the Public Theater is doing a theater version of one of the stories in your first collection.
Yes.
And you wrote the play?
Yeah, this was... God bless her. But this is right after the first book came out. Nora Ephron had read it and took me to Barney Greengrass and had the idea that she saw is a story called The 27th Man about four writers who were killed under Stalin. You know, it was a story I'd heard about Stalin killing the end of the, you know, Yiddishists and the last of the anti-fascists in the 50s when he was killing basically everybody who could be killed and some who couldn't. But I just thought these writers deserved a story and I wanted to write them one. But Nora saw the play in it and I just ran off to write a novel for a decade. But as soon as that decade was done, as soon as the novel was finished, I've been working on this play with her and then the Public Theater, and they have been with Barry Edelstein, my director, and Oscar Eustace, the brilliant artistic director. I just can't believe as an adult that I have been given the gift of this education. Who gets to learn to interact with drama at that level?
Well, one of the greatest playwrights of all time wrote short stories, Chekhov. Is there a connection, or is this a very different process?
There's a connection to my secret medical practice. No, but
movies, often the movies work better if they're adapted from short stories than if they're adapted from novels, just because there are just so many details in the novel, so many digressions.
I guess it's just seeing what your brain works with. I'm just interested in working with other forms, and I have to say, they're symbiotic. They live together really well, but it can't be any more different. It's almost shocking. I had to relearn. I mean, that was the excitement for me. It's starting at square one again. It's just. Dialogue, you know, the way we are talking now, this is, you know, one set of dialogue that doesn't work in fiction. When you read a book, it reads as dialogue, but it's a whole different form and a whole different timing. Dialogue for theater, it was literally starting at square one. I had writer, you know, to have an actor read it, they'd be falling off their chairs, passing out for oxygen. I'd write them lines so long, people have to breathe. It's just a whole new, it's my mind is spinning, but I'm addicted. I have about 90 more plays I want to write.
Nathan Englander's short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, numerous anthologies, including the Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. His novel was The Ministry of Special Cases, and his third collection of short stories, the one that's just out, has gotten wonderful reviews, front page review in The New York Times Book Review, is What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
So nice to see you and in your new offices. It's beautiful.